Reflecting on the death of Moses, the writer of the 34th chapter of Deuteronomy said, "Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all these signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his officials and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel." This is Dr. Jim Tomkiewicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College. At the 2017 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Bible scholar and Wyoming Catholic College professor Jeremy Holmes reflected on how the exodus from Egypt to the Promised Land and the life of Moses illustrate the theme of returning from exile. Here is his lecture in its entirety.
So I was asked to speak about the book of Exodus for this event, and you have a text in your reading packet, which was, that translation was chosen on the basis that it's public domain, so I could legally print it. It's the Douay Rheims, but I went through and updated the English a little bit for easier reading. The Douay has the interesting history that it is not a translation of the Hebrew text. It's a translation of the Latin Vulgate, which is a translation of the Hebrew text. So while I was in there, I also cleaned up the famous peculiarity of the Latin Vulgate, where Moses comes down from the mountain having been talking with God, and St. Jerome, misreading one Hebrew word, says he did not know that he had horns. And so you have Michelangelo's famous statue of Moses, and his hair has these little twisties right there. It's because Michelangelo couldn't quite, anyway. You see lots of art with Moses, either with actual horns or with a funny, pointy hairdo, like he's the boss out of Dilbert. And it all goes back to Jerome and one Hebrew word. The books of the Hebrew Bible in the Hebrew tradition, they had a very pragmatic way of naming them. They would just name them by whatever the first word was. But when the Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek in the period just a couple of hundred years before Christ, the translators then at that point chose names that they thought sort of summarized or encapsulated what was in the book. So, for example, the book of Deuteronomy, it's a Greek word, the Deuteronomos, the second law, because they thought, well, he seems to be giving the law a second time. Exodus is similar. It's a Greek word, Exodus. It's not a Hebrew word. And so as a Greek word, it has a Latin sister word in which the D of Exodus becomes T, and you get Exitus, from which we get our English word exit. So you could make an argument for titling the book Exit in English. It's a book about an exit. It's a book about people who were unhappy with their situation and, with God's help, got up and left. I think that the concept of an exit, of making your exit, contains already some of the questions that we'll have to deal with by the end of the day. That is, what is the situation they're in? Why are they unhappy with it? Those sound like easy questions, but they're surprisingly difficult for the people in the situation. The events that we're going to be talking about happened, because we don't have a calendar date, right? But an estimate would be around 1290 BC, somewhere around there would be the actual historical Exodus. Of course, the book of Exodus is written later, and some parts of it much, much later, as we'll talk about. The Exodus, the story that we want to talk about today, is the center of gravity of the Old Testament. There are lots of other more beautiful texts. There are lots of other more spiritually uplifting texts. But this is the heavyweight in the Old Testament. It is the story of how Israel, the main character in the Old Testament, how Israel came to be. Before the Exodus, you have a bunch of people who were descended from Abraham. After the Exodus, you have the nation of Israel. You have the protagonist of the story going forward. this would be, when we think of the Old Testament, I think our minds gravitate towards all the laws, you know, reams and reams of them, you know, lots and lots of laws. And those are important, big deal for the Jews of Jesus' day. But the Exodus is a bigger deal. In a way, kind of like we have, you know, July 4th, we have parades and parties and shoot fireworks. Constitution Day, I'm not sure I could tell you when that is. No, it's thank you. So the day that we regard as our nation's birthday is the one that gravitates to the center of our attention. That day made the Constitution both possible and necessary. And the Constitution is a big deal to us. You know, that's a lot of our political debate rotates around the Constitution instead of around July 4th. But in our consciousness, July 4th is the heavyweight. And it's that way with the Exodus. The Exodus is the birth. When you move into the New Testament, surprisingly, it stays the same. The Exodus is the heavyweight. If you go to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, what you're going to find is what Dr. Glynn did for us last night. You have the story of Adam and Eve sort of in first place in the treatment of our situation. That's the first thing you need to know, Adam and Eve. And the fall, and so on. And if you go to, you know, St. Thomas's Summa, before the Incarnation, you have the Treatise on Man. And in the Treatise on Man, first thing, Adam. And we have to talk about the fall, right? The story of Adam and Eve in the garden and the fall is the big setup. You get into the New Testament and look at how does the New Testament itself present Christianity. Adam's not the heavyweight. The name of Adam is mentioned 7 times in the entire New Testament. At key moments, very important doctrinally. Moses, the name Moses comes up 77 times. Right? References to the fall of Adam and Eve occur at a few key spots that, you know, we could go through. The references to the Exodus are everywhere. You can't pick up a book of the New Testament without getting into the Exodus. So the story of the Exodus remains important even into the New Testament and even into today. If you go to the Easter Vigil, that liturgy, if you don't know the story of the Exodus, you're just lost. Why do we keep singing about water and what's the candle? And, you know, it's the symbolism of our major liturgy in the year rotates around this story. And that's reflecting the fact that that's how the New Testament presented our salvation in terms of this story. How do you get into the center of gravity of the Old Testament? I mean, in my imagination, something that is the center of gravity is very, very dense, and that's true of the story of the Exodus. There's a lot going on. How do we find a track into this story? What I'd like to do, what I think will unlock it, is to pick out one person who was involved in the Exodus, Moses, and simply focus on his story. Now that's going to leave a lot out, and I'm hoping that in our seminar we can bring back in some of what we're leaving out. But I think if we follow Moses, we will we'll come to the heart of the matter. Moses is a Roman Catholic saint. In both the old and new calendars, his liturgical remembrance is September 4th. You can pray to Moses. Holy Moses. Holy Moses, which I did before stepping up here. St. Gregory of Nyssa wrote a mystical work titled The Life of Moses, which is a highly, highly allegorical treatment of Moses' life. I'm not going to go very allegorical today. I want to just stick to the story, which is in many respects familiar to everyone. I mean, maybe you've read board books to your kids. Maybe you saw Disney's Prince of Egypt. You know, I don't know. I hope you saw Charlton Heston in The Ten Commandments. Wonderful movie. Very nicely done. But what I want to do here is not like those projects where they're trying to fill in missing material to imagine what might have happened. I just want to stick to the text and what it tells us and just go through the story. So in a way, I feel kind of bad. You were promised a lecture, and all I'm going to do is tell a story. But I think it will be helpful. And when we're done with the story, I want to take just a couple of minutes to orient us to what the New Testament then does with this story. But for right now, you know, you're in a library. It's story hour. And I'd just like to tell you about Moses. So, the early years. Moses was born under a death sentence. Pharaoh had decreed that all male children of the Hebrew race were to be thrown into the Nile River, and Moses was born into that Hebrew race. He stood condemned before he had a chance to commit his own crimes. But he was saved by a pair of women. First, by his clever mother. She obeyed the letter of the law. She threw her son into the Nile. But before she threw him in, she put him in a basket made of bulrushes and sealed with pitch so he would float. Second, he was saved by his compassionate stepmother. She found the child crying in his basket and determined to adopt him as her own and raise him in Pharaoh's own house. She gave him the name by which we know him today, Moses. Now, this was a moment full of meaning. The Hebrew word that's translated here as basket actually only occurs twice in the entire Old Testament. It occurs once here, and occurs once before in the story of Noah, where our Bibles translate it ark. Like the basket, the ark was sealed with pitch. Like the basket, the ark carried a great man to safety through the waters. And this moment was to define Moses' entire life. His very name means one who was drawn from the water, saved by a peculiar providence out of all the Hebrew male children. But this moment and these two women set up an ambiguity in Moses' identity. Is he Hebrew or Egyptian? Does he belong to Pharaoh's house or to the race of his birth? When he was grown, he saw the burdens of his people, and he defended one of his own race by killing an Egyptian. Here, he definitely seems to be a Hebrew. But his own people rejected him. They said, "Who made you a prince and ruler over us?" And he was forced to flee into the wilderness. He ended up in Midian, where he helped some women water their flocks at the well. And when the women's father asked how they had come home so early, they explained that an Egyptian had helped them. And Moses married one of the women, and she bore a son, and he named the boy Gershom, based on the word for sojourner, saying, "I have been a sojourner in a strange land." What does Moses mean? His own people have been sojourning in a strange land for about 400 years, but in the immediate context, he seems to mean that he is an Egyptian, exiled from Pharaoh's house and sojourning in Midian. Moses knows he is an exile from his home, but which exile? Which home? This is the Moses whose life would be turned upside down one day when he turned aside to look at something interesting. He was shepherding the flocks at Mount Sinai when he saw a bush that was burning but was not destroyed by the fire. Now, Moses had been living as a shepherd for quite some time now. He had seen a lot of bushes. He had seen a lot of fires. What kind of fire can it be that burns but does not consume? He had to find out. To his absolute horror, when he approaches the bush, he discovers too late that God is hiding in the bush. "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Moses hides his face, afraid to look at the deity. God gives him the good news that the time has come to save the Hebrews from their slavery. Then God gives him the terrifying news that he has chosen Moses for the job. Moses objects. "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" "Well," God explains, "you're the one I've chosen, so I will be with you." Moses objects again. "You? If I tell the people of Israel that the God of your fathers has sent me, they're going to ask me, what is his name? What can I say to that?" Here God seemingly gives him the runaround. "I am who I am," he replies. And with this non-answer, he launches into a detailed account of exactly how the liberation from Egypt will work. Moses is not going to ask for the people's liberation, you see. but only that they be allowed to go a few days' journey into the wilderness to worship. But Pharaoh will resist to the point of calamity until the Egyptians are glad to give the Israelites presents just to see them off. But Moses isn't ready to talk about in-game strategies. He's still unhappy about that first step, the one where he has to go talk to Pharaoh and to the people of Israel. "They won't believe me," he objects. "They'll say the Lord did not appear to me." So God gives him a miracle to perform and offers a demonstration for Moses. "Throw your staff on the ground," he commands. Moses throws it down, and the staff turns into a snake. And the hero of our story runs from the snake. God gives him still another miracle to perform, sort of divine credentials, and so settles the question of how the people will believe that the Lord has appeared to Moses. But Moses is not finished objecting. "I'm not a good speaker," he explains, as though God maybe didn't see that detail in his employee file. "I am slow of speech and tongue." God's reply is crushing in its logic. "Who made man's mouth? Who makes him dumb or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth." Before the next major textual division in the book of Exodus, Moses will object to his mission a total of 7 times, a number signifying completion. He objects to the bitter end. But for the moment, his arguments have been answered, his reasons resolved, and the only logical thing to do is go. So he begs. "Oh, my Lord," he says, "send, I pray, some other person." By this point, the sacred text tells us, God was angry with Moses. In frustration, he gives Moses his brother Aaron as a spokesperson. "He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God." Access to God is going to be more indirect than planned. The people were supposed to see God represented in Moses. Now they're going to see Moses represented in Aaron. All right. And with that, our unlikely hero is almost ready to undertake his great liberation of the people of Israel. There remains just one more event in Moses' life before the Exodus begins. An event so strange and disturbing that commentators find themselves at a loss. As Moses was traveling to Egypt in obedience to God's command at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and sought to kill him. As at the beginning of his life, Moses is saved by a woman. His wife, Zipporah, grabbed a flint knife and cut off her son's foreskin, touched it to Moses' legs, said, "You are a bridegroom of blood to me." And suddenly, the Lord left Moses alone. Strange and disturbing. Why would God seek to kill Moses, whom he had just commissioned, with great difficulty, you might add, to save his people? And why would circumcising the boy fend off the angry deity? The whole scene is dark, ominous. With some hesitation, given that this is a sort of classically difficult passage, I'd like to suggest a direction. We have to recall that this is the boy named Gershom, as a memorial of his father's exile, his exile from Egypt. In naming the child, Moses had erected a permanent marker of his self-identification, not as a Hebrew, but as an Egyptian. As Moses heads back to Egypt to see how his kinsmen are doing, it's what he says to his father-in-law, which is as ambivalent a mission statement as one could ask, God sets himself with deadly intent, not against that Hebrew boy we saw rescued from the Nile, but against the Egyptian prince mourning the loss of the courts. By rapidly imposing on Gershom's flesh the sign of the chosen people, Zipporah reestablishes the boy as a memorial of Moses' membership in the covenant of Abraham, and so changes the meaning of his name. Gershom shall no longer remind Moses that he is an Egyptian sojourning away from Egypt, but that he is a descendant of Abraham sojourning away from the promised land. Moses is ready to lead his people out. So we move on to the War of the Gods. Moses arrives in Egypt, facing his fears full on. He wonders whether the people will believe him. He wonders whether he can face up to Pharaoh. This latter question, at least, will be decided in a grueling match of 10 rounds, by the end of which the Lord will practically hold his opponent on the ropes so he can pummel him longer. Along the way, Moses will come into his own as God's chosen leader. To see the drama behind the 10 plagues, it's helpful to see how they are organized based on where and how Pharaoh is warned of the coming disaster. And you can see this hopefully in the bold print. I'm not sure if I bolded it in the handout. So in the first plague, warning is given in the morning by the water. In the second plague, warning is given at some unspecified time inside Pharaoh's palace. In the third plague, no warning is given. It just happens. And this is a pattern that repeats twice more. In the morning by the water, inside at an unspecified time, no warning. And then again, in the morning by the water, unspecified time in the palace, no warning. So the 10 plagues fall into three sets of three, with the death of the firstborn standing apart on its own and taking up a lot more text than any of the others. The first trio of plagues, water turned to blood, frogs, gnats, this gives us what you might call Aaron against the magicians. Aaron performs a miracle, the court magicians duplicate it. Aaron performs another miracle, the court magicians duplicate it. Aaron performs a third miracle, the court magicians can't duplicate it. They warn Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Now, given Aaron's success in these first three rounds, this first trio, you'd expect our victor to move on to the next round, yeah? But we actually never see Aaron perform another miracle. It seems that once Pharaoh's minions have been vanquished, Moses' minion can step aside as well. From this point on, it's going to be Moses against Pharaoh. Moses, who was as God to Aaron, steps into his role as the antagonist of Pharaoh, who was worshipped as a god by his people. So in the second trio of plagues, God performs the first two miracles directly, and Moses performs the final miracle of the set. The third trio, hail, locusts, darkness, brings a new theme. God warns Pharaoh, I will send my plagues upon your heart. Moses performs all the miracles. With the first plague of this trio, this final trio, Pharaoh begins to bend, confessing for the first time that he has sinned. So after the second plague, Moses' servants panic, begging him to relent. Pharaoh's servants panic. Pharaoh begins to bargain about conditions for letting the people go, well, a short distance into the wilderness to worship. You know, who goes? What does this involve? The next miracle involves more bargaining. The hearts of the Egyptians are beginning to give way, but still Pharaoh's heart is hardened. With the 10th climactic disaster, Moses brings the duel of the gods to a close, and he steps into a new role. As you can see there in your handout, this is structured chiastically, with the centerpiece of this whole section being the directives for the 7 days of unleavened bread. This is going to be a liturgical commemoration that Israel is to keep in perpetuity. So up to this point, Moses has been giving commands or directives for the moment. Do this now, do that now. Right here, he's beginning to be a lawgiver, someone who sets down a pattern that is to be followed from here forward. Now, Israel, whom God has identified as his firstborn son earlier in the story, is saved by the blood of the lamb in what then becomes the Passover ritual. Will all the firstborn of Egypt die? In a panic, Pharaoh orders Israel out of the land. Get out. Go away. Be gone. As God had commanded, the Israelites asked the Egyptians for gold and jewelry, and the Lord gives the people favor in the Egyptians' eyes. And the text adds, moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. It's come a long way. Now, at this point, the match is over. Pharaoh is beaten. But against all reason, Pharaoh jumps back into the ring for one more try, pinning Israel against the Red Sea. And when Pharaoh draws near, the people of Israel see him coming and they begin to have doubts. They say to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." They sound a lot like the old Moses. But they're dealing with the new Moses. "Fear not," he says. "Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again." One of the great lines in the Old Testament. There follows the most spectacular miracle in all the Old Testament. There's a reason why movies keep being made around this scene. With more than a passing reference to the creation of the world, Moses stretches out his hands and there's a wind moving over the waters that divides the waters to reveal dry land for the newly created nation to walk on. With an even closer resemblance to the flood of Noah, at Moses' command, the waters crash together behind them to drown the entire Egyptian army. The Israelites saw the Egyptians they had so feared washed up on the seashore, and, quote, "they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses," end quote. Moses' fears are now set aside. Pharaoh is defeated, and the people believe in him. From this point forward, Moses will discover all the other objections he should have raised at that bush, except that they never occurred to him. To begin with, the people are conflicted about leaving Egypt. When they run out of food, they wish they had never left Egypt. "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full." When they run out of water, they wish they had never left Egypt. "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst?" And what's more, when things go wrong, the people blame Moses. "You have brought us out," they say. "Why did you bring us out of Egypt?" The dark side of their firm belief in him is that now they hold him accountable for everything that happens. "What am I to do with this people?" Moses complains to God. "They are almost ready to stone me." But each time, God provides Moses with the miraculous help he needs. When the food runs out, God sends the divine manna. It's this, you know, flaky stuff that appears all over the ground that they can gather up and make bread with. And the people look at it and they say, "What's this?" Which in Hebrew is manna. Right? And so I always wish that Bibles would translate, would call this stuff, "What's it?" That would be the best translation. They ate what's it in the desert for 40 years, whatever that was. When the water runs out, God tells Moses to strike a rock and make the water come forth for the people. Eventually, Moses gets the people to Mount Sinai without getting stoned. The scene here is impressive. There were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. No preacher has ever thundered from the pulpit like God did when he gave the Ten Commandments. "First and foremost, have no gods before me. Make no graven images. Keep the Sabbath holy." The people listened, but they were overwhelmed. It's too much. They backed far away and said to Moses, "You speak to God and we will hear, but let not God speak to us, lest we die." So Moses went alone up the mountain to receive the rest of the covenant. On his return, he built an altar. He solemnized the people's union with God, sprinkling the people with blood, For their part, they swore, "All that the Lord has said, we will do." And then Moses made his way back up the mountain to receive further instructions, leaving his older brother Aaron in charge. And the sacred text tells us that the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. And Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Well, 40 days and 40 nights proved to be too long for the people. All along, they have seen Moses as the agent at work in their exodus. All along, they have seen Moses as the one responsible for everything good or bad about their journey. Having grown up in Egypt, where Pharaoh was God, and having seen Moses best Pharaoh in the fight, they seem to have attached themselves to Moses as formerly they would have been attached to Pharaoh. Even though they agreed to the commandment forbidding idols, it seems like they've already found their graven image in Moses. And without him, they're lost. Godless, you might say. And what's more, they saw with their own eyes that Moses walked into a bonfire the size of a mountaintop. And he never came back. They don't say this in so many words, but they assume he's toast. They hold out for a while. Moses has done some pretty amazing things. Maybe he can walk out of a furnace. But after more than a month, they are done waiting. And this is key. This is key. They don't understand. Remember, this is the fire of Sinai. It burns, but does not consume. In their ignorance, the people demand of Aaron, "Up! Make us gods who shall go before us. As for this man Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." When Aaron gathers donations of gold, the very gold they had taken from the Egyptians in victory, and fashions it into a typically Egyptian golden calf, the people cry out, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Then they get a big party ready in honor of their gods. They eat and they drink, and they rise up to play. Probably a euphemism for breaking all the rest of the commandments that they haven't already shattered. Now, little do the party people know that their actions have provoked a deadly game of hot potato up on the mountaintop. The Lord breaks off his discourse to Moses to say, "Go down, for your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, but of you I will make a great nation." Moses responds, "Why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you brought forth out of the land of Egypt?" As we say these days, not my circus, not my monkeys. Now, we have to step back and realize God just made Moses an amazing offer. Moses can be the new Abraham. We'll scrap this first effort and start over with Moses. Now, Moses declines the promotion with two rapid arguments. First, what would the Egyptians say if you bring the people out in the desert just to kill them? Consider your reputation. Second, you did make a promise to Abraham. Now, this whole scene on the mountaintop is strange. I mean, to begin with, why does God say to Moses, "Let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them"? It's as though God is pointing a flamethrower down at the camp and Moses is standing in the way. It's like, if you would just step aside, I could nuke this people. Now, in reality, God has any number of ways of killing people. We've seen 10 of them on display already. Later, we see God open the earth to swallow people whole, send fire straight from heaven to consume people, send deadly serpents to bite people, and on and on. The dialogue on the mountaintop could just as easily have begun like this. "Never mind, Moses. I just consumed the people." He doesn't need Moses to let him alone. He certainly doesn't need Moses to tell him that he made a promise or that his reputation is at stake. What is God doing here on the mountaintop? I would suggest God is pushing Moses toward one last transformation. God takes the people's position for a minute, that Moses was responsible for getting them out of Egypt. And that provokes Moses to take the opposite view. God threatens to destroy the people. That provokes Moses to intercede for the people. We see this final maturation of Moses unfold over several scenes surrounding this disaster that has just happened down at the camp. After returning to camp to reestablish order, Moses again turns to the Lord. "Alas, this people have sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sin, and if not, blot me, I pray you, out of your book which you have written." "You can destroy the people," Moses says, "over my dead body." This is the guy who begged, "Send, I pray, some other person to save the people." Now, at Moses' insistence, God backs off of his earlier harsher statements. And he says he will send an angel to bring the people into the promised land. But God himself will not go with the people because they are a stiff-necked people and he would probably destroy them. Moses objects. "You keep saying I have found favor with you, but you won't even go with us." God relents. "My presence will go with you and I will give you rest." Here, Moses issues another of his ultimatums. Look at how he speaks to God by this point in his life. See how far Moses has come. He's delivering ultimatums. And this may be the most important insight of his story. Moses says, "If your presence will not go with me, do not carry us up from here." Moses is saying, if God will not go in the midst of the people, there's no use going to the promised land at all. It wouldn't even be the promised land without God's presence. He says, "For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from all other people that are upon the face of the earth?" What is it about the promised land that makes it so different? That makes it be promised, right? What is it about the chosen people that makes them so different? One word: God. God himself makes Israel's homeland home. Moses has discovered that his exile is exile from God. His sojourning in a strange land is life far from God's face. The Lord repeats that he will indeed go in their midst for Moses' sake. And Moses keeps pushing. He goes to an even more audacious demand. "Show me your glory." Boy, we've come a long way from that day on the mountain when Moses hid his face, afraid to see the deity. Now he's not only speaking maybe over boldly with God, pressing his case, making demands, he even pushes on to the unthinkable. "Show me your glory." "I will make all my goodness pass before you," God agrees, "and I will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, but you cannot see my face. For man shall not see me and live." Interesting moment for the question of the relationship between this story and Moses' exile. And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand upon the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." I'm not going to stop here and try to unpack what is God's back? What is this covering with the hand? But there's something there that seems central to the story. There follows on the scene a solemn remaking of the covenant that Israel had shattered by their idolatry. When Moses came down from the mountaintop, unbeknownst to him, the skin of his face was shining because he had been talking to God. The people were afraid to come near him when they see his face glowing. You can just imagine the scene here, you know, somebody walking down the mountain trail towards you, you know, the sort of glowing light bobbing and illuminating everything. And that is creepy. I'm going to get myself a little further away from that. And he has to call to them, assure them that it's him, bring them to him so he can talk to them. But when he's done talking, he covers his face with a veil. And from that point forward, Moses keeps a veil over his face. He'll take it off when he talks with God, and he'll have it off when he comes out and delivers the message to the people, and then he puts the veil back over his face because they can't bear to see him. Now, this scene with the veil, just it speaks volumes about the contrast between Moses and the people. The people are in a lot of ways like the early Moses. Like the early Moses, they passed safely through the waters that drowned others. Like the early Moses, they fled Egypt, pursued by Pharaoh. Like the early Moses, they wandered out into the wilderness. Like the early Moses, they thought of themselves as far from home, but identified home as Egypt. Like the early Moses, they met God in a fire at Mount Sinai. And finally, like the early Moses, they soon found God set against them with deadly intent. But the similarity stops there. They did not go on to understand the fire of Sinai. When Moses first encountered God, he begged that God would send someone else to free the people. Now he offers his own life for the people. Back then, he put forward his lack of public speaking ability as an excuse. Now he's speaking confidently to an entire nation. Back then, he trembled in front of the burning bush. Now he walks into the blazing mountaintop. Back then, he was terrified, afraid to see the deity. Now he asks to see his glory. The contrast with the people, it's bleak. While Moses longs to see God, the people are afraid to see the face of the man who saw the back of God. Yeah. Moses has gone on the Exodus. By comparison, everyone else went for a walk in the desert. Yeah. Now, from this height of glory, I kind of wish I could just stop, say, you know, the end. Great. I hesitate to go on with the story. Moses' life doesn't turn out the way we would expect. All the Israelites who left Egypt with Moses came to the very border of the Promised Land and refused to enter. Too scary. They decided to go back to Egypt. So as a consequence, God condemns them all to wander in the desert until dead. That sentence has a ring to it. You know? Wander into the desert until dead. So they never escaped their exile. Either their exile from the Promised Land or their exile from Egypt. Their children are always the sign of hope, right? Their children were to enter the Promised Land in their place. Now one day, near the end of their sojourn in the desert, the people once again ran out of water, as tends to happen in the desert. And as always, they blamed Moses. Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness that we should die here, both we and our cattle? And why have you made us come forth out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? Even after the fiasco of the golden calf, they can't shake their semi-idolatrous tendency to see Moses as their God. Now, remember, they ran out of water earlier. God told Moses, strike a rock with his staff and make water come forth for the people. This time, God tells Moses to take his rod and speak to a rock and make water come forth. Moses, however, has had it with the people. Moses, whom our sacred text describes as the meekest man in all the earth, has played nursemaid to these perpetual infants for 40 years. And when he and Aaron come to the rock with the staff, Moses explodes in anger. Hear now, you rebels! Shall we make water come forth for you out of this rock? And he pounds on the rock with a staff. Water comes forth. Everyone drinks. Crisis is averted. But God is displeased. He says, because you did not trust me to sanctify me in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Now the people had fallen into their usual fault, attributing everything to Moses. Why have you made us come forth out of Egypt? And Moses, in his anger, using the exact same Hebrew verb, come forth, plays right along. Shall we make water come forth for you out of this rock? You want to chalk all this up to me? Fine. Look at the trick I can do. He attributed the saving work to himself and to Aaron rather than to the Lord. As God puts it, he failed to sanctify the Lord in the eyes of the people. Now, elsewhere, we get a gentle portrayal. Psalm 106, for example, puts all the blame on the people. It's a wonderful psalm that recounts this same story of the journey through the wilderness. It recounts seven sins of Israel in the wilderness. And this incident with Moses, it puts down as the seventh sin of the people. The psalm says, "They angered him at the waters of Meribah, and it went ill with Moses on their account, for they made his spirit bitter, and he spoke words that were rash." But God holds Moses responsible, nonetheless. And the penalty is severe. For this one offense, Moses will not enter the promised land. At the very end of his life, having brought the second generation of Israelites to the very borders of the promised land, Moses ascends a mountain one last time. In what sounds like a mystical vision, really surpassing what could have happened with physical eyesight, the Lord allows him to see the entire land Israel is going to possess from border to border. And the Lord says to him, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." So Moses died there and was buried. Our sacred text points out that no one knows where he was buried. Given that the first generation of Israel clung to him almost as a god, this is probably a wise precaution. You wouldn't want a cult of Moses springing up at his burial site. But it adds a note of pathos at the end. This great man, you know, who saved and sustained Israel, you can't even go to his tomb? The text now leaps forward. The perspective suddenly leaps forward to a much later time, from which later time some anonymous author, we don't know who, looks back. Here's what the text says. "And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, none like him for all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great and terrible deeds which Moses wrought in the sight of all Israel." So a lot has happened since Moses died on the mountain, right? Joshua brought the people into the land where they were faithful for one generation, as long as Joshua was alive. As soon as he's dead, the Israelites took up the idols of the Canaanites, hoping for the kind of political and economic dominance that the people around them seemed to have. Then God gave them a king to stabilize the political, economic, and religious situation, and they made an idol out of the kingdom because of the political and economic prosperity it brought. The prophets warned repeatedly, "If you do not turn to the Lord, you will go back to Egypt. You will go into exile." And finally, God expelled them entirely from that land Moses saw as he died. From this vantage point, our anonymous Israelite writer notes wistfully, there never has again arisen such a prophet like Moses. We need him now more than ever. We're in bondage in a foreign land under foreign gods, and we need a new exodus. But you know, where could you find a prophet like Moses? Where could you find anyone who speaks with God face to face? What prophet could work miracles like Moses? Miracles capable of overthrowing the empires of the world. And supposing you did find such a prophet, wouldn't the people just cling to him as a god? Where will we find a savior who will not only bring us out of bondage, but for whom there just won't be a temptation to put himself in God's place? Yeah. And so ends the story of Moses, with a palpable feeling of exile. You know, you end and you think, really? That's how it ends. So that's the story of Moses. I wish it could be a little more uplifting at the end. I want to take just a few minutes to say a couple of things about what the New Testament does with this story. It's impossible to do it in any detail. It would, you know, you'd have to go through volumes. Like, as I say, the story of the Exodus and Moses is everywhere through the New Testament. But just a couple of things. You get to the end of the Old Testament, you turn the page, And right from the first page of the New Testament, Matthew's Gospel, here we are. The years before Jesus' ministry, he escapes the death sentence passed on all the Hebrew male children. He finds safety in the bosom of Egypt. He comes forth from Egypt. In his baptism, he passes through the waters. He goes out into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, after which he goes up on a mountain and gives a law. Yes, Matthew is seeing Jesus as Moses. That's the lens he's bringing to bear. And this comparison of Jesus and Moses will run through the entire New Testament, but with a twist. This is not the Moses who didn't enter while the people went ahead of him and entered. This is the Moses who entered ahead of us. He went ahead and forged the way into the promised land so we could follow him. I want to pick just one other place in the New Testament almost at random, picking a thing that comes to mind. In his first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 10, Paul says of the whole story of the Exodus, "These things happened to them, the Israelites, as a warning, but they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages has come." So the story is written for us. And he says, this is interesting. He says, "I want you to know, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same supernatural food, and all drank the same supernatural drink. For they drank from the supernatural rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things are warnings for us." So out of everything the New Testament does with the story, I just want to point to one thing. In a very consistent way, the New Testament locates us in the story. We have been baptized. We have received communion. We are out of Egypt, but not in the promised land. We've gone on the Exodus, but we have not entered that home. We are in the wilderness now, in the period of trial. A theme in Paul's letters, in the letter to the Hebrews, is that just as those people were under the trial and failed, so we are under the trial and it's up to us. Will we enter that land or not? And to do that, we're going to have to answer the same questions that faced those Israelites. Which exile? Which home?